Yay, record.
Also, I'm really happy to see that the JM that is present is Jared Madison and not what I initially thought.
Oh, I thought I would, just keep a spot there.
Yeah, thanks for that. I'm gonna re-swallow my heart now and just get that back down here.
Yeah, you just
Whoa,
gotta figure, hold on a
excuse
second. I
me,
gotta figure out
sorry.
how to arrange all this nonsense. Hold on
Sorry, I'm being attacked by my cat.
That's one of the best ways to be. Oh, look at that.
Yeah, 8 pounds on top of me, eight on the
Eight.
disc. No, 16 total.
Fantastic. All right. Well, we've assembled a pretty good crowd here, so I believe we will go ahead and get started if that's all right with you, Brother Polnak.
Great.
First thing I'd like to do is welcome everybody and say thank you so much for joining for the second monthly Friday with Friday tonight. As you've seen in the post, my name is Dave Friday. Over my right shoulder is my teacher's aide and partner in crime. For those that have not met her, this is Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, or WTF for short. MBB. It's always great to have a dark cat in a dark window so that all you see is just a pair of eyes staring back. Always great. So, with those things in mind, I would like to start by introducing our keynote speaker for the night, I guess, the discussion facilitator. Excuse you. I have a bit of an intro to read. Pianist Karl Polnak is a keynote speaker, writer, workshop facilitator, and national thought leader on the power of music. He has keynoted major national conventions such as Texas Music Educators Association, Organization of American Kodaly Educators. Please correct me if I'm wrong. Phi Mu Alpha Sinfonia, Iowa Bandmasters Association, CBDNA, Michigan Music Conference, and many others. His writings on music have been cited or excerpted in numerous publications, orchestra program books, and quoted in official testimony to the United States Congress. Carl served as director of Boston Conservatory's Music Division from 2002 to 2013, and dean of the School of Music at Ithaca College from 2013 to 2020. Previously, he held faculty positions at Tanglewood, Music Academy of the West, Round Top, and Madeline Islands Festivals, as well as the University of Minnesota and University of Southern California. His work in opera includes conducting and coaching positions at several universities and festivals, including the Tanglewood Music Center, where he was a member of the team responsible for the historic 50th anniversary performance of Peter Grimes. Carl participates in national leadership with several organizations. He was elected to the National Executive Committee of Phi Mu Alpha Sinfonia, which honored him with the Signature Sinfonian Award in 2011. He served for 6 years as an elected commissioner of the National Association of Schools of Music Commission on Accreditation and works as a visiting evaluator and consultant for NASM. He is an associate and consultant with the Aspen Leadership Group. Devoted to practices that cultivate joy in his own life and the lives of others, Carl's interests include developing and coaching authentic leadership, mission, and vision work, and building high-performing teams in high-joy environments. He lives in Ithaca, New York, with his husband Dave and their dog Mato. Carl is an intern chaplain at the Cayuga Medical Center in Ithaca and is currently completing a 400-hour certification in clinical pastoral education. He is also a passionate, inexperienced potter and spends several hours a day covered in mud. Brothers, it is my honor to present to you tonight our speaker, Brother Karl Polnak.
Thank you, brother. I have to trim that introduction.
Respectfully disagree. I thought it was great.
Wow. And I have to fix the end because it's several hours scraping mud off the wall where it has mistakenly landed. Thank you very much for that that intro, and thank you very, very much for this series. People are looking for ways to keep each other afloat. You know, it's almost like we're on a life raft this past year, trying to reach the shore. It's kind of like Noah's Ark 2, you know, and we're huddled in this craft trying to wait till we hit dry land again, which hopefully will be soon. With the vaccines now running around, hopefully we will soon be able to gather. But I really appreciate efforts like yours to keep us together and to have us have some community. I often will write out in very painstaking detail things I'm going to say to groups. And I didn't do that tonight because I sort of feel like you're family. And I feel clear enough about what I want to say to you that I have not scripted it. I have some notes, and I think I probably will talk for about 15 or 20 minutes. And my intention is to say things that are helpful. I hope that this will be helpful. I know that all of us have experienced loss. Maybe some of you have experienced extreme loss. You've experienced the loss of a person due to COVID. But certainly, even those of us who are fortunate enough not to know a single person who's had a case of COVID, and I don't know if those people still exist anymore, if anybody has been untouched by COVID, but even if that's you, I know that you've experienced a lot of loss. There's a tremendous amount of social loss and contact loss that we have with each other. And so I want to try to say some things that that will be helpful. And to what I hope to do is to contextualize this, because this is not the first time that this has happened. It might be the first time that it's happened in your life, especially if you're younger. But it's not the same first time that it's happened to us. And I want to put some context around disruption, which is the name I give for it. When a boulder drops into your path in your life, and you're headed on a highway, and you're in your third year of a 4-year program, and you know where you're going, or you're in the fifth year of a job, and suddenly there's a boulder, and there's no path forward, and or there's a loss of a person, there's a loss of a partner or a friend or a grandmother, and there's disruption, and I want to talk about that a little bit and contextualize that. 100 years ago, 1921, the primary source of income for American instrumentalists was what? More American instrumental musicians had this job than any other job. What was it? Anybody? Anybody know?
Military band?
Nope.
I'm going to go with pizza delivery.
Although U.S. military is still to this day the largest employer of musicians on the face of the earth, the largest single employer. But more American musicians made their living doing this thing in 1921 than any other thing. I'll give you a hint. It doesn't exist anymore. Nobody does this for a living. Not a single person.
Either vaudeville or music for theaters, movies.
Playing in silent film orchestras. That was the predominant form of employment for American musicians in 1921. Now, to give you an idea of how big film was, remember that there was no internet. there was no kind of home entertainment. We're far away from television in 1920. In fact, the first radio station, KDKA in Pittsburgh, was 1920. So there was no commercial radio before 1920. There were Victrolas. There were lacquer discs. that people could play at very low volume and very low fidelity. But there was really nothing like seeing film. There was no visual stimulus at all in the home. People had to go out to movies to see visual stimulus. And here's the impact of film at that time in society. The average American family went to the movies once a week, even during the Depression. Even during the Depression, when people report not having enough money to feed their families or clothe their families, the average American family went to the movies once a week. All right. So each of those silent films had an orchestra, and the music for silent films, which I was lucky when I was a music student to be able to, I went to school in Rochester, where there was a big library of silent film books, of the books that people used to use to play for silent films. And the music wasn't composed for specific films. It wasn't through composed. It was chunks of existing classical music. So, you know, when the person, two people were falling in love, the conductor would cue the meditation from Thais and you'd play that. And then you'd cut. When the scene stopped, you just stop. Turn the page, and then you'd play a Rachmaninoff prelude as the army was coming in. And then you'd stop, and you'd turn the page, and you'd play Midsummer Night's Dream for some forest music. And then you'd stop and turn the page. So there was a conductor, and there was a book of pre-existing classical pieces, and the orchestra would just start and stop. It was relatively crude by today's standards, but that's how it worked. And it employed a lot of musicians. Kodak, which was based in Rochester, New York, a company owned by George Eastman, called Eastman Kodak, was the primary producer of film in the United States. There was almost no one else producing film. How many of you owned a Kodak camera or used Kodak film at some point in your life? How many of you have never used film ever? You've only used digital photos. Do we have anybody that young? We have, you know, collegiate brothers now who I'm sure they've never touched photographic film. They probably vaguely know how it works. But Kodak was the big producer of film. And Kodak, in 1921, ascertained that the thing that was limiting their ability to sell film was there was a pinch point, which was there were not enough musicians in the United States to fill all of the classical, to fill all of the silent film orchestras that needed to be filled in order for them to maximize their ability to market film. And so George Eastman, as a philanthropic gift to his community, formed a music school called the Eastman School of Music, which was a philanthropic effort, but it was also, it had a sneaky side business effect for George Eastman, because the more classical silent film musicians there were in the country, the more film they could sell. And that school was founded in 1923, and the original charter was to train musicians for silent film orchestras. In 1927, the first talkie came out, and by 1930, there were no more silent films. So that idea lasted 7 years, because there were no more silent films. Everybody who played in a silent film orchestra was unemployed by 1931. Because people wanted the talkies. They didn't want canned music. And then the Great Depression hit in 1933-34. And so people talked about the end of the world for classical musicians. They just said how will there ever be work again for classical musicians? And the way that we made music was disrupted. It was stopped pretty much. And then, you know, you don't need me to tell you that music did not stop. We had more classical symphony orchestras crop up in the 30s and 40s and 50s in the United States than we had ever had. I'm not able to find this number, which really annoys me, because it should be around somewhere, but I'm quite certain the number of symphony orchestras, professional symphonies, must have doubled or tripled during that period of time. All those musicians went into that. We had the recording industry, which we did not have previously, and many musicians made their living recording. And then if you jump to the, you know, Spielberg, John Williams collaborations, lo and behold, we're back to music and film, except in a really sophisticated way, where studio musicians in Hollywood are making quite a nice living, and the level and the quality of what we're doing is back. And so you can see that one of the basics of disruption is that disruption and innovation form a pair. And if you find innovation, if you find the creation of something new, you almost always find disruption. You know, if you find the transistor and semiconductors, you'll find a whole vacuum tube industry disrupted. You'll find disruption and innovation coming in a pair. And this is true throughout throughout music. Interestingly, Kodak just kept making film. And they just kept making film. And they said, we're going to just keep making film. And we're going to make great film and better film. And digital video started coming out and digital SLRs. And Kodak said, we're going to make great film. And Kodak is bankrupt. Kodak is bankrupt. Eastman has a $2 billion with a B dollar endowment. And that's how that worked out. Kodak formed a music school. The music school didn't have a purpose after 7 years. Their great idea kind of ran into a brick wall. The music school is doing quite well, and Kodak filed for bankruptcy because Kodak wasn't willing to self-disrupt. They weren't willing to say, you know what, guys, we got to do something other than make film. You know, I know everybody likes making film and we're really good at making film and that's what we want to do. And we'll just make better film or make it cheaper or make, no, we got to stop making film. We got to find some other way. Now it's interesting. Kodak made this rather pathetic effort. I don't know if those of you who are into digital video watch this, but there were Kodak digital cameras toward the end, right before they went under. They were not nearly as good as the people who really got into digital video and decided that's what they were going to do, right? They made kind of a feeble attempt at the last minute to go, oh yeah, me too. Yeah, we do digital video too. And it was too late. They went under. So that's one story about disruption to consider. Another model that many of you, I'm just looking at the age of the audience, you all remember the Blockbuster video thing. You remember driving, you got in the car and you went out and you drove to this store and they were always, I don't know, kind of ugly stores. They were like cinder block stores or something. And you went in and you got a video and you picked it out and Blockbuster, I think at one point, probably every big town had a Blockbuster, you know, every few blocks, there was a video place, right? And then Netflix came along and said, oh, we'll send it to you in the mail. You don't have to get out of you can stay in your pajamas, go online, click a button, tell us what you want, and it'll come in a mailer to your house and you can watch it. And then put it back in the mailer and send it back. And now, of course, we have streaming video. We don't go anywhere to get our video. But when Netflix came along, that's another example of disruption in business, where something, it's kind of like the meteor that allegedly eliminated the dinosaurs. It comes out of nowhere and it hits, and life is different after that. And whether life is better or worse kind of depends on whether you're the disrupted or the disruptor, you know? Life is not as good for Blockbuster now, and it was much better for Netflix. And Netflix was smart enough to ditch the mailer thing and get very quickly into streaming video. Had they not done that, had they just said, oh, we'll mail it to you overnight, we'll get it there, you know, FedEx, we'll make it cheap, they would have gone under, right? The only way for them to have done that was to self-disrupt, to say, we can't keep doing this. We got to stop this. So the disruption innovation pair are really critical in creativity. We I hate to say this, but we require disruption for creativity. We can't be creative without disruption. All of you in this room only know me because of one majorly disruptive event. Had this event not occurred, none of you would know me. I wouldn't be in this room. I wouldn't be in this organization. What was the disruptive event? Yes. Had 9/11 not happened, I wouldn't be here and you wouldn't know me. And most people wouldn't know me. I don't think most people know me because of how I play the piano. Most people know me because of the piece I wrote after 9/11 that went viral. That's why most people know me. And that was a disruptive event. I was a musician living in New York. I did not move there to have buildings bombed. I moved there to play concerts. And my being disrupted that night made me react to that event in a way that I felt compelled to write something. And when other people read it, they felt so compelled by it that they felt the desire to post it. And a brother named Marco Beiger, does anybody know Marco Beiger? Found that piece online and sent it to Jon Bon Jovi, who sent it to the NEC. Marco said, this guy writes like he's a symphonian. We should make him a symphonian. And President Bon Jovi got it and said, you write like you're a symphonian. We'd like to make you a symphonian. We're only together because 9/11 happened. I would have never met you otherwise. And so that was an incredibly creative event for me. Now, I want to put a couple caveats in here. I'm not happy that COVID is happening. And if you've experienced loss about COVID, I'm not going to glibly paint a silver lining on that and say, oh, it's great. It's a great thing. You know, lean into it. It sucks. And I don't want to suggest that, you know, terrorists attacks or cancer or addiction or the other ways that I see people disrupted all the time are things that I would wish on you or things that are somehow light. They're not. They are profound in their impact on us, particularly because they're not light, because they require our entire being to respond with all of the weight that we have to push back on something. And in fact, because we're in the vaccine era, and you may know that the vaccines we've been using are called primer booster vaccines. You get a primer shot, and then 3 or 4 weeks later, you get a booster shot. And I had a prime boost. 9/11 was the boost. The prime for me was that in 1994, I was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer, and I did not intend to have the surgery, which was a rather involved surgery, because I didn't think my chances were good enough of surviving to warrant the surgery and the recovery. And so my dad, the night, you know, when you have surgery, you're consented. You have to sign consent forms saying I'm going to have the surgery. And the consent forms were in my room for 2 days and I hadn't signed them. And the night before, I told my dad, I'm not going to sign these papers. And my dad really wrestled me into signing the papers. My dad and I are really close, and my dad can still get me to do almost anything. And so he got me to sign the papers. And because the cancer that I had was so serious, it's almost always fatal. It made me get into a headset of, I'm probably going to die, but in the next few years, maybe I'll do X or maybe I'll do Y. And after 5 years, when it became clear that I was going to survive that cancer, it totally changed my life. I had gotten tenure at Ithaca College. I was going to stay at Ithaca College for the rest of my life. That's all I wanted. I wanted a job with tenure where I could just settle in. And I left that, I gave up tenure and left that job 2 years after I was hospitalized. and went to the University of Minnesota and just figured I'm going to live dangerously, you know, while I can. I'm going to take all kinds of chances. And then 9/11 happened and that peace happened. And I don't know, I've been in kind of free fall ever since. I live dangerously and take all kinds of chances. And I was the guy who was going to play it safe and get a tenured job and just hang on and be there. So that disruption, that kind of prime boost disruption for me really gave me my life. And it's in the energy that we summon to come, you know, to rail against the disruption that we become who we are. You know, we, each of you becomes who you are, not, I think, so much because of all the nice things that happen to you in life, but by the energy that you have to summon when you come against something, when you come against the boulder in your path, and you have to summon this energy that shows you who you are, that proves to you who you are, reminds you who you are, you know. And in some cases, people find who they are. And the thing I think about a lot, because I'm not good at this, we're not as good at self-disrupting as we are about being disrupted. If somebody drops a boulder in your path, there's nothing else to do about it. But if you're like me, you get a few pounds overweight, think, okay, it's time for me to change what I'm eating, and I can't self-disrupt. I have to wait until my pants don't fit before then I get to the point of like, okay, I either have to buy new clothes or now I have to lose weight, you know? I am like Kodak. I think, well, I'll just make better film. I'll just make it cheaper. I'll just keep going in the way that I'm going, even though I know it's not really sustainable. I'm not good at self-disrupting. I'm pretty good at responding when I'm disrupted. I've had good responses when I'm disrupted, but I'm not good at self-disruption. And so I don't know that any human being is good at self-disrupt. I don't know that any human being is really good at doing something that works for a long period of time and voluntarily saying, I'm going to stop doing this thing that's been working for a long time because there might be something else. Usually it's an external force that does that to us. And I have seen this with people. I have loved and worked with a lot of people with addiction and alcoholism. And disruption is often the point in recovery where people make progress. So somebody has a problem with a substance and they're sneaking by. It's not sustainable, but it keeps working. And then they lose a job or they have a DUI or their family leaves them. There's something that hits that really disrupts their life. And the response in that moment by that person is sometimes people don't respond well, and many addicts and alcoholics ultimately die, but some people respond heroically. I mean, some of the people that I admire the most in my life are people who had addiction and alcoholism who responded heroically, summoning, I don't know where they got it from. I don't know where they got that kind of energy, but really saving their own lives, you know, and coming into recovery. So what I want to propose, and all of you in this room, most of you in this room, I don't see a lot of current collegiates, but still for many of you in this room, and I think for any iGens, any people who are current collegiates or maybe under 25, I want to suggest to you that this is your 9/11. This is the thing that will define your life in terms of how you respond to being disrupted. I've seen much written that says we won't simply like go back to our lives when this is over. Life as usual won't be as usual. It's been disrupted. Business won't just go back to everybody flies everywhere for a meeting, not after everything that we've done with Zoom. We'll probably still get together once in a while in business, but I think you're going to see lots of changes. We will never teach the way that we taught. The idea of, you know, of a whole bunch of 22-year-olds showing up at Tuesday on 2 to listen to Professor Smith drone on and on and on and kind of make it up on the spot, that's just a shitty way to teach. That was never good enough. That was never good enough. Why should the person have to come Tuesday at 2 when they have a splitting headache, when the presentation, if it's a lecture, could be prepared with all the handouts there, with everything there, so that they can watch it Tuesday at 8 when they feel better? So a lot of the things that we did in colleges, we knew weren't state of the art, weren't cutting edge. And like Kodak, we just got nailed. It's like, you waited a little too long to, you waited a little too long to get video friendly. You waited a little too long to organize your handouts rather than fumbling through them in front of the class. You can do that in a classroom. You can't do that on Zoom. We got nailed. We got caught. We got disrupted. I'm glad we got disrupted. People should be taught better than that. And we learned that there are some things that you just absolutely have to do in person. You can't teach piano by Zoom, not to a new student. You can't do psychotherapy by Zoom with a new student. You can do it with a client that you've already established a relationship with, but you can't build trust by Zoom as well as you can build it in person. There's things we've learned that only work in person, and there's a lot of things we've learned that we'll never go back to. So I guess I want to throw out there a question. If people would like to share, you're welcome to share anything you want. You're welcome to share ideas, contrary ideas, challenges to what I've said. But what I'd love to invite you to share is, if there's a piece of your life that you don't want to go back to, what is it? If there's a place where you are welcoming being disrupted and this has made you think, you know what, I'm going to do that differently when I have the chance, what is that? And if there's something that's been disrupted that you really grieve, if you've lost a grandmother or there's really something damaging about this, you're welcome to share that too. Like I said, it's not my intention to whitewash this or to forcibly silver line it, but I do hope to maybe entice you with the idea that we need to be disrupted every once in a while. It's good for us to get disrupted every once in a while, even if the source of the disruption is not a good thing, as it very often is not. So I will close there, and I'm welcome to have people just join in and share your thoughts and pour your drinks, and here we are. Good to be with brothers again.
Well, first thing I'd like to say, Brother Polnack, is thank you. The chat was rather active during all of that, and I think that a lot of us were really feeling what you were putting down there. I know that 9/11 was quite an impact on my life for a completely different reason. but that's actually something I want to get into later tonight after I've poured myself a drink. Most definitely. I actually wanted to respond to you as an educator, because you were talking about how the face of teaching has definitely changed through all of this. I also was a tenure-seeking professor at an institution of higher learning, Macomb Community College, who, we'll give them a quick plug today, has provided me the professional account to Zoom, which allows me to have as many people in here as I want for as long as I want. So that's why we're able to do this tonight. Good on them. What I have gotten out of all of this, when I was seeking tenure, one of the things that I had to do was create an ILP, or an individualized learning project. And I decided to go the technology route and say, I am going to maintain a YouTube channel. And on the YouTube channel, I'm going to post examples of problems that students want to see so that I can eventually start building up this fantastic library of these amazing problems. So I have been teaching at MCC since 2012, and I believe that in my first 6 full academic years there, I uploaded approximately 40 videos. That's an average rate of about 1 every other month. I was really, really making a lot of progress. Once the pandemic hit, I decided to repurpose my YouTube channel. And since that has taken place, I have uploaded several hundred videos of mini lectures, example problems, and the such. That is going to be something that is now going to exist for as long as I want it to exist while I'm an educator. So if I have students who, for example, can't make it to lecture because they have a headache, I'll say, that's fine. Go to our learning management system and watch these playlists that have been posted. And since I do feel like giving everybody just a little bit of PTSD, I would also like to share the lecture notes that I have been live creating during our sessions. You can actually see this one is dated 3 days ago. These are my lecture notes from this past Tuesday. One thing that I make it a point to do for every single one of my class periods is begin with the meme of the day. So usually something lighthearted. I always tell them this is never a personal attack at anybody, but if you feel personally attacked, then feel free to be offended by this. But then we go on in our sessions to talk about all sorts of different sorts of math and whatnot. We go through example problems. I try to make sure that students are engage through the chat if they want to, through their microphones if they can, have their video on, which they never, ever, 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 ever do. But it's new. It is disruption. This has been my response to the general disruption. And I'm now being yelled at by Garrett through the chat, because it seems that at every single one of our meetings, I have to reference the lecture notes that I create. But this was in direct response to you talking about how the face of education can potentially change. And in a lecture-based class like mathematics, absolutely. If it's going to be some boring guy up here just talking at his students, might as well make it a video so that our lectures can be a little bit more interactive, or class periods can be a little bit more interactive.
Here's a good question. And the disruption thing kind of brings this to mind. Have people felt like their boundaries have changed? One of the challenges in working from home is that there's no commute anymore, right? Which, you know, on the face of it, seems like a great idea. But on the bad side of it, is there really a start to your workday and an end to your workday? And or how are people managing that, right? I mean, I know I find that to be a major challenge in public accounting, because that industry is notorious for not having boundaries to begin with. So I'd be curious to hear what other people say as far as that goes.
I'm a college professor, and there aren't boundaries right now because all of my kids are suffering. And part of my job description is that I have to give them my cell phone number that they can text me until 11 p.m. at night if they're in crisis. We've been fighting this, but we found that it keeps retention. And retention in this time when most colleges are down hundreds of students, dare I say almost thousands, retention is a big deal. And in a music department like my school, you know, we can't afford to lose 5 tenors. That would destroy us. So yeah, it's made a big deal. The boundaries are even through, I'm letting the kids into my house and seeing that we have too much shit. But what do? You know, you make it work.
Funny you mentioned boundaries there. I received an email with a quiz submission from a student in the last 10 minutes.
I'm still trying to figure out this whole just thing. I'm changing jobs in the middle of the pandemic, finding myself going from working with my best friend ever to having to start a whole new work relationship in a whole new town. Thursday was the first time that I was actually at the university longer than just the time it took to get into my classes and back out of the building. I think I've been to my office twice because there's no social reason to. I can't sit in my office and have kids come in and talk to them and listen to them. They schedule Zoom meetings with me, which, you know, I'm glad they feel free to do that, but it's not the same. And where, you know, by the end of band camp last year at Grand Valley, I was like, you know, part of the family. Here, I'm just now almost halfway through the second semester feeling any form, shape, or fashion of connection to people. And it's, we can't go out and have lunch. We can't sit down and grab drinks. Everything is, when can I schedule an online meeting with you or shoot me a note about that? But the thing is, we're trying harder. It's, I feel like even though it's not working out as well as it could, people are at least trying to connect. And it's not just my fellow professors, it's family members, it's friends. I've talked to more people this past year than I've talked to at almost any point in my life. Just because, you know, that whole, like you said, disruption, you don't know what's going to happen next. So connect and make something good of it. Having to do student teaching observations, not in person, there's so much loss of that. You can't feel the room. It drives me nuts. You can't feel the energy of the kids feeding off the teacher, but we've made it work. We've had some good times with it, but the problem is we lose steam. And Carl, it really touched me the way that you shared about how your battle with pancreatic cancer gave you that drive to push forward with your life. I feel like I'm starting to lose a bit of my steam from my personal great event, but just because I think we're all losing steam. We spend so much time feeding off of each other that we're all worn down. And that's the big goal. It's, if I get worn down, I usually draw strength from someone else. But right now, we're just all exhausted. And that's the hard thing to push through. But we find a way. And that's the good thing. And it's things like this that help get that energy out there.
If I could quickly add, I think the disruption idea makes us creative is being shown in my own area of expertise with opera companies and stuff like that. They're literally changing how they provide service. We are learning through several different platforms how to actually rehearse together, even though we're nowhere near each other. Things like Soundjack and Sonus and Jam Kazam and all these different things. They all have varying degrees of wonder whether they work or not. I literally have directed two operas this year that have been completely virtual, where I've never been in the same city as the people. And learning how to actually use a Zoom web camera to film something while they're singing, usually by that time lip syncing to something they've already recorded, has really changed how the business is going to work. And I don't see that going back to the, okay, I'm going to this city for 6 weeks to sing in a show or direct a show and then go back home. I see that the whole business in on the professional side of delivery of music and theater is going to completely change. And I find that fascinating. And I'm actually kind of excited to see where it's going to go. Being a tiny bit of a avocational techie, I really want to see what's going to happen with this.
Anyone?
I can jump in. So I teach K through 8 English language arts, which is super fun because I have everything from students, you know, sounding out the word cat, k-at, cat, and blending it all the way through my eighth graders writing their Midsummer Night Dream essays. And so Carl alluded earlier to the idea of things that work and things that don't work. I don't think I've ever been a better middle school ELA teacher than I've been this year. Getting a ton done, being forced to adapt to things like Google Classroom has made me way more organized, which has just always been a weak spot of mine as a teacher. Like, the assignments are there for the students, even if I forget to write it on the board or they forget to copy it down. Like, it's all online, which for me personally has been great. I'm not naturally that organized, and being forced to discover a whole new set of tools has made me a much better teacher. Things that don't work. Kindergarten online. I would love to tell you it works. It straight up does not. The students can read, which is frankly nothing short of a miracle, but it's a lot of time. And I'm very lucky to work where I work and have really outstanding parents, but I also recognize what I'm about to say is not sustainable for the vast majority of students across the country. I've basically kind of created a model at this point where, like, I'm coaching parents on how to teach their kids, and then parents are implementing things. And then I'm meeting with the kids on Zoom. I'm meeting with the parents on Zoom. And, you know, I'm explaining, like, to parents when you teach consonants, not to add, like, you know, an extra schwa at the end of it, because it's going to cause problems later when the children go to blend the. And, you know, so I've had to, like, teach parents to teach their kids to read, which of course is not their job, nor is it sustainable for the rest. You know, I teach at a small experimental school. Like, our goal is to demonstrate learning science and then publish it. And, like, that's not going to work in a public school where you have, you know, in New York City, the legal limit is 33 kids in a classroom and both parents work. And so, I mean, we've learned, I think, a lot about what you can do and you cannot do online. But we're really starting to hit some boundaries of what you cannot do.
So we've heard quite a bit from the educators in the crowd. Is there anybody who's not in education that wanted to talk about sort of the inspirations that you've had, your silver linings out of all of this?
I am not in education. I avoided that route early on. I wanted to go back a little bit before, but to Carl's original topic of disruption. I love the topic. Sorry, I'm so dark. My camera does not allow me to focus on my actual, it focuses on the background, not the foreground anyway. So I can't get the stick on my face. So I'm actually here and present. Some of the discussion point reminds me of, like, the, you do with it what you can, whatever you have, it's up to your reaction, how something happened. Pull yourself from the bootstraps. It's up to you to make what you will of your situation. But some of it I agree with, and I think Carl wasn't trying to allude to some of those points that I don't agree with, of how everyone reacts to a disruption, to an event, to something happening differently, and it takes time to respond to that. And so just because you haven't read 8 million books, or just because you haven't created something new, or just because you haven't responded, or you spend your days at home with your pets, that's not the wrong response either. Because we all have our own valid reasons. We all have our own emotional, our own personalities, and we have our own responses to events. And a disruption doesn't have to be an event, I don't think. And I think, Carl, you alluded to that, but I feel like we kind of talked about more of, like, catastrophic events almost, and how you respond to that and how can you be better for it. But I think too, just responding in general is okay, and sitting in that and reveling in that is okay too. And if Carl, I saw you unmiked if you wanted to speak to that, but
yeah, I think this is a really important point. And in fact, I was going to look for a way to sneak this in, and you kind of gave me an opening, but The silver lining, if there is one, in my experience, is so delayed that it almost doesn't seem related to the original event. Like, don't think, you know, I'm going to come out of COVID and I, you know, by May, I'm going to have this, I'm going to come out of COVID fat, out of shape, and with, hopefully not with liver damage, but here's me during COVID. My go-to is I work out frenetically. I'm a big workout person. I work out in a gym. I can't work out at home. I like to go to a gym, get into the gym, work out. Gym's closed. So I went from drinking one glass of wine every once in a while to a glass of wine every night to two glasses of wine every night to two glasses in a Manhattan, right? Then I thought, okay, I better stop that because that I don't want to go there. Then I started gaining weight. Now I'm so enlightened from COVID that I'm back at the gym and overeating and overdrinking, all three. Like, I'm out of coping mechanisms. Like, I'm just waiting for it to end. And when it ends, am I going to be spontaneously, you know, 6 months later, are you going to hear from me? Wow, now I've done. No, it's probably going to be, you know, I didn't write that piece the night, a couple of days after 9/11, thinking, oh, this is going to go viral. I wasn't thinking anything was going to happen to that piece. I was writing how I was feeling. And I had post-traumatic stress disorder for years after 9/11. I think that's where me and Dave really like kind of started drinking heavily in 2002. The aftermath of 9/11 was that it sucked. The aftermath of cancer was it sucked for like 5 years. Cancer sucked for a good 5 years after it was over. So it's not a response to, the initial response is this sucks. I really think that's our initial response. And then beyond that, the place where we're disrupted, where that piece of life can't go any further in that same way. You know, what I would suggest to you is, don't expect this to happen right away and don't try to make it happen. It will happen to you. It will happen. You know, I guess my invitation is, are you open to being disrupted and letting life play with you a little bit? You know, life played with me. I was a guy, I wanted to get one job, get tenured, and live the rest of my life in that town. And life played with me, took my head apart a little bit and said, How about you give up? I've given up tenure three times. I've had tenure and given it up three times. I don't know anybody who's given up tenure three times. My parents were ready to have me committed. They thought I had gone off the deep end. Because life pulled my head a little bit and said, how about if you're this guy instead of that guy? You know, how about if you move here instead of move there? How about if you do this instead of that? And I didn't do it. I didn't do those things to myself. Life kind of played with me and picked me apart. And so I guess my invitation is, are you willing to allow yourself to be disrupted? You won't know where it's going to go. And you don't often get a say in where it's going to go. You get a say in, yes, I will allow myself to be disrupted. I will allow myself to be played with by life and pulled in directions that I wouldn't have picked for myself, but I'll go. I'll be curious. It won't happen. I doubt that it will happen this year. Maybe it'll happen this year. Maybe there are people, I know there are people who've sold houses in big cities and moved to the country and just decided they were going to change their lives. But maybe it won't happen for 3 years or 5 years. The piece that I wrote that went viral, I think I wrote in 2004. So it took me 3 years from the event to think about what I wanted to write about that event. And then it took another 4 years for it to go. It took, you know, till 2009 for Symphonia to find me. So it's not instant, and it's not something we do. It's not something I would expect you to do in response. And in fact, I would say it's not something you can do in response. All you can do is let yourself be disrupted. You can't pick the form of, I didn't allow myself to be disrupted and said, I'm going to write a piece that's going to go viral and then I'll become a symphonian. It just had nothing to do with me. The only piece that had anything to do with me is I'm going to put my feelings down on paper. That's all I did. So I would say, you know, say to you, it's an invitation of will you allow yourself to be disrupted? And will you let go of control a little bit in terms of where that moves you, where that takes you? Are you open to life taking you in a slightly different direction as a result of this event?
To piggyback a little bit on your disruption, when the universe decides to play with you, you have two options. You can allow it to have you and work with it, or you can work against it and lose. The universe is going to play with you. How you deal with it is what makes you who you are. And if you're stubborn, like I and several others in this room have been, and said, no, that's not going to happen. Well, guess what? I moved from Cookeville, Tennessee to Atlanta, Georgia, and I've held the same job now for 21 years, somehow still mostly sane, doing tech support. My degree is in history. I don't use it a bit. So, yeah, sometimes the universe makes you change. It's how you deal with it.
You know, part of what I hear in this also is the idea of humility and allowing yourself to be humble enough to be changeable, teachable, you know, whatever the right word is for that. But, you know, that humility to allow that to happen to yourself rather than to be so stubborn. And in my experience, it's difficult to know when you should be stubborn and when you shouldn't. Tough choice to make sometimes. And I think it's those choices that really define the path of our lives. Should I have been so stubborn and stayed in school and gotten another degree? Or did I make the right choice by leaving when I did and moving halfway across the continent? Those sorts of things. We'll never know. We'll never know if the path we took was the rosier path or the darker path. Part of the fun of life, I think.
I'm reminded of trying to get a man to go see a doctor. You should really have a doctor look at that. No, I'm fine with the whole stubborn thing.
Well, that's the way it's always been for me. I'm really bad at God has to do the sort of the knock me off my horse kind of thing. And it's usually for me, it's come either by my mother passing or getting laid off, or in one case, losing a relationship. But I've been really bad about, like, I did make one voluntary, I have made a couple of voluntary like moves. And some of them worked out, and some of them, actually two of them worked out badly and one of them worked out well. So, yeah.
Well, if it's all right for me to interject, I just want to say thank you one more time to Brother Polnack. I think that you've given a lot of us a lot of things to contemplate. It'll be interesting to see once the pandemic is over how we respond to the disruption that has taken place. Honestly, just having listened to this talk, I have a slightly more positive outlook for what is to come, perhaps a little bit of hope, which I think we could all use right about now. So just one more time, thank you to Brother Polnack for the fantastic talk tonight.
Thank you. Thanks for having me, and thanks for sponsoring this series, which I think is just a great, just getting us together is such a gift. So thank you.
I am looking forward to making this a monthly thing. Now, quick plug for next month. I am still planning on doing the first Friday of every month. Next Friday with Friday then would be April 2nd. And I don't want to make anybody feel like they have to be here. But if you are here and it extends beyond midnight, it will then officially be my birthday. So no pressure, but definitely show up. Pardon me, but that is the best Friday right before Easter. Okay, right here. Thank you. Friday's birthday at Good Friday with Friday and Easter.
Yeah, Saturday with Friday just as an alliterative. Have you thought about rescheduling your birthday?
I have thought about rescheduling my name.
Dave, I'm curious how that comedy routine's working out for you.
I haven't quit my day job.
Probably for the best.
Most definitely. On a related note, if there are presenters or topics you would like to have considered at the next Friday with Fridays, please definitely get a hold of me. The reason that Brother Polnack was invited to this one is because another brother brought up his name and said, hey, he would be a great guy to have here. So I am very open to the suggestions of brothers. If you guys know somebody who would be a good fit for an event like this, by all means, let me know. Now, my hope is that moving forward, we are going to go into the more social aspect of the evening now. If we want to discuss Brother Polnack and the topic of disruption and the rise to greatness, or call to greatness, excuse me, further, most definitely. However, in the meantime, I am going to grab one of those tasty looking beverages that I'm seeing in so many of the other windows here.
And the recording is now...